uphill fight to reach the NCAA tournament following a loss to Minnesota over the weekend. The Illini travel to Ohio State tournament, Ohio State tomorrow night. The Buckeyes, of course, blew them away earlier in the year, 72-53 at the Assembly Hall. Illinois closes out the regular season at home against Wisconsin on Sunday. The University of Illinois women defeated the Northwestern Wildcats in Evanston, that over the weekend yesterday. That defeat was at 58-48, the Illinois women over the Northwestern Wildcats. And the Chicago Blackhawks will end their Olympic break tomorrow night when they face the New York Islanders on the road. Fans will get a chance to honor the Blackhawks' Olympic competitors, including the four medalists, Wednesday night when they host Edmonton. And finally, John Danks has been chosen to start the first official spring training game for the Chicago White Sox. That happens Thursday against the Los Angeles Angels. Randy Wells is scheduled to start the Chicago Cubs Cactus League opener on Thursday against Oakland.
I'm Diane Adams. My friends call me Dee Dee. I was born blind. My husband worked with visually impaired older folks. He would talk about the radio reader. He'd say, I ordered this radio reader for so-and-so, and so one day I said, I would really love to have one of those.
At the Illinois Radio Reader, local newspapers, books, and magazines, and periodicals are read and recorded by over 70 volunteers, and then those programs are broadcast to those visually impaired people who have our radios in their homes.
It is literally our newspaper. I feel we as visually impaired people are so privileged to have a service like this. I'm Dee Dee Adams from Decatur, and WILL is my source for the Illinois Radio Reader.
You are listening, of course, to WILL. It is Illinois Public Media. The United States and European nations have been pushing for more sanctions aimed at Afghan's neighbor, Iran, and Iran's nuclear programs. Now these nations are focusing on the biggest opponent to sanctions. That's China. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing that China faces a balancing act between its ties to the United States and its growing strategic partnership with Iran.
While the U.S. now sees sanctions as all but inevitable, China insists that diplomatic channels have not been exhausted and that talk of sanctions is premature. Li Guofu is a Middle East expert at the China Institute of International Studies, a think tank under the foreign ministry. He says that sanctions would only push Iran's nuclear programs in a more military direction.
If we persist in sanctioning Iran, isolating it and backing it into a corner, then we may end up with a result which nobody wants to see. This is exactly what China is trying hard to avoid.
Li says that the U.S. and Europe's relentless push for sanctions against Iran makes him suspicious about their motives.
Do Western nations really want to resolve the Iranian nuclear issue through peaceful diplomatic means? Or are they simply using the nuclear issue as an excuse to achieve other aims, such as overthrowing the Iranian government?
China and Iran have extensive commercial ties at stake. China is now Iran's biggest trading partner. Iran is now China's third largest oil supplier after Saudi Arabia and Angola. The two countries on opposite ends of the ancient Silk Road are planning oil pipelines across Asia. John Garver, a China expert at the Georgia Institute of Technology, considers the implications.
It would mean that a major oil supplier in the Middle East would probably be willing to work with China to deliver oil to China, probably through overland channels, in the event that some type of U.S. and Chinese confrontation led to the interruption of China's sea lanes of communications.
Willem van Kemenade is a visiting fellow at the Netherlands Institute of International Relations. He says that the heirs to the Chinese and Persian empires share common interests as they reemerge as regional powers.
The two think that China being the dominant power in East Asia and Iran in future in West Asia can create a new type of stability that would extend not only to the greater Middle East but also to Central Asia.
China has backed three rounds of sanctions against Iran, but it has first tried to ensure that the sanctions are limited and reversible. John Garver says China may go along this time too, but
China doesn't give things away for free. So if China agrees to come on board in these sanctions, or even not to veto them, to abstain, the Americans are going to give something. And I'm virtually certain that China would be pushing for, you know, look, you got to give us something on Taiwan. You can't just keep making all these demands and not give us anything on our core issues.
Garver points out that China was once Iran's primary supplier of nuclear technology. It agreed to drop that role in 1997, but it has repeatedly linked the non-proliferation issue to U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. China has recently threatened to sanction U.S. firms that sell weapons to Taiwan. That threat, though, Garver observes, makes it harder for China to object to the use of sanctions as a matter of principle. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Well, here's a report on two vastly different perceptions of the same criminal defendant. To Americans, she's a terrorist with a mysterious past. To people in her native Pakistan, she's a victim. She's become a symbol of the way the U.S. has mistreated Muslims. Her name is Afia Siddiqui, and she was arrested in Afghanistan. She's convicted of attempted murder at a trial in New York. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston has the first perspective on the case.
To hear U.S. officials tell it, Afia Siddiqui was on the run from 2003 to 2008. She was on the FBI's most wanted list for almost 5 years. Then Afghan authorities found her loitering outside a provincial governor's compound in Afghanistan in July 2008. They thought she might be a suicide bomber, so they arrested her. But that isn't why she was in a U.S. court. She stood trial in New York because of what happened after that. Prosecutors said she grabbed an M4 rifle and fired on the U.S. troops and FBI agents who came into the Afghan police station to question her. They returned fire, and she was shot in the abdomen. Her lawyer said she never grabbed the rifle. Afia Siddiqui's story before her arrest is even more mysterious. She claims she went missing for those 5 years because she's been in U.S. and Pakistani custody and that she was tortured at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. U.S. sources tell NPR none of that is true. They say they've been tracking her on and off for years. But her whereabouts weren't at issue in court. Instead, it's all about the shooting. And it's all about whether Afia Siddiqui, once a student at MIT and Brandeis University, was competent to stand trial. Siddiqui was ejected from the courtroom for outbursts. One observer was arrested, so it was hardly routine. In the end, a Manhattan jury found her guilty in February of all 7 counts against her, including attempted murder. She faces life in prison. Sentencing is scheduled for May. It's unclear whether she will appeal. The mystery of what happened during those 5 years remains unsolved. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.
And I'm Todd Gleason at WILL in Urbana-Champaign. Now we'll continue our report on the Siddiqui case with Steve Inskeep.
So let's try to keep the facts straight here, since there are such differing versions. She's well-educated. She had lived in the U.S. The American version is she was mysteriously missing for 5 years, suspected of terrorist activities, and then suddenly turned up in Afghanistan and tried to kill people. The other version from her supporters is that she was in custody those 5 years, tortured and raped before being accused of a crime she didn't commit. But let's get a Pakistani perspective on this from Fazi Zaka. He's a columnist for the Friday Times, which is an independent news weekly in Pakistan. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
What was Afia Siddiqui's life like before the events of the last several years?
Well, a lot of it's still shrouded in mystery. She was in the U.S. She came back. Then at one point, she suddenly disappeared. But mostly it's perceived that she's been in jail, held by the U.S. in Afghanistan, thought likely to be held in very poor conditions. But the main thing that seems to have very resonate with most Pakistanis is that her 3 children are missing. And the accusation is that even though while she's been held for alleged crimes, it seems that the children have paid for it as well.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned the perception in Pakistan, because when this case has been covered in the United States, it has mostly been described as a straightforward case of terrorism, a little strange perhaps, but she was caught in Afghanistan doing something, and she, according to the trial anyway, picked up this weapon and tried to fire. It sounds like when the Pakistani media described this very same woman, this very same case, the assumptions are all very different.
Yes, because the U.S. media describes her as a highly educated woman who's had a privileged stay in the U.S. while Here in Pakistan, the description tends to be more of somebody who's far more frail, and as was evident during her trial, whose mental status was suspect. And in addition, one of the main gripes in the Pakistani media seems to be is that she's been convicted for something that happened under circumstances that are not entirely clear in Afghanistan. But the main crux of the allegations that stem, 5 years earlier, being a member of Al-Qaeda, running money for them with blood diamonds and a number of other things, that has not made its way to the criminal justice system.
And if she was a terrorist, people are saying, why wasn't she ever really tried for charges of links to Al-Qaeda and so forth?
Absolutely. The primary charges that got her on the radar are the ones that have not been tried. And this is an issue which resonates mostly with the religious right, but it also has a lot of average Pakistanis. If you look at Facebook these days, there are a lot of Pakistanis who've put up her picture in their profiles. And that's just to sort of highlight the case. It's seen as the U.S. system railroading someone who may be innocent in most people's eyes.
I feel the need to keep repeating some of the basic facts here, what little is known. She was missing for 5 years. One question is where she was. The U.S. says we don't really know. Pakistanis and her supporters claim that she was in some kind of custody, first with Pakistan, second maybe with the United States. Have Pakistani journalists been able to uncover any evidence suggesting that she really was snatched by the authorities at some point?
Not really. Actually, one of the main people who've been pushing the case is a journalist called Yvonne Ridley, who was also held by the Taliban at one point, and subsequently she converted to Islam. And she's one of the people who's been pushing this case as a miscarriage of justice. Even Pakistani journalists cannot say concretely, where Afia Siddiqui was for those 5 years.
Has the coverage of this case in Pakistan increased suspicion of the United States within Pakistan?
Generally, yes. Legislators in Pakistan are siding with Afia Siddiqui. In addition, the government of Pakistan has paid costs for her defense in the U.S., and even the president of Pakistan has requested that she be repatriated to Pakistan on the grounds that she's not entirely fit to stand trial and also because they suspect the case has not got merit.
Is it too much to say that the differing perceptions of this case have had a poisonous effect?
Well, I think it's definitely one of those things that have created a lot of tension and mistrust between Pakistan and the U.S. In addition to this, there are issues of the Pakistani government not granting U.S. state officials visas in order to process the aid that's been promised. So it's a number of things, and it culminates mostly with the drone attacks, which are extremely unpopular in Pakistan. So I wouldn't give too much credence to this as an individual thing, but in a long series of events, yes, it is poisoning the atmosphere of cooperation between the two countries.
Fazi Zak is a columnist and also a television host of the satirical news program News, Views, and Confused in Pakistan. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
That was NPR's Steve Inskeep. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason at WILL, Illinois Public Media. Well, an Olympics that began with the death of a loser closed with an exuberant celebration of Canada, reflecting a determined comeback by the host country's organizers, athletes. A crowd of some 60,000 jammed into the BC Play Stadium for the closing ceremony, and many were delirious Canadians abuzz over the overtime victory by their men's hockey team earlier in the day to give the host nation a Winter Olympics record of 14 gold medals. That means there's real magic in their Winter Olympics, but as you'll hear, there's real danger, too. Commentator Amy Guida explains the legal consequences of athletic competition in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
If you watched the Winter Olympics, you may have seen Lindsey Vonn lose control on the giant slalom course and crash into a safety barrier. Perhaps you saw various teams skidding their sleds during the bobsled runs and sometimes winding up upside down. And of course, we all heard about the tragedy involving the Olympian from Georgia who died during a training run on the luge. The Winter Olympics has a very real set of dangers, and we witnessed that repeatedly this year. After seeing all that, you may have wondered if Olympic or Olympics-bound or Olympics-hopeful athletes have sued after such accidents. The quick answer is yes. At least one made it into the law books. You might also wonder if such lawsuits are or would be successful. The quick and general answer is that they're tough to win. And the reason is because of what we all recognized as we watched, that ice and snow and the need for speed combine at the Winter Olympics and yet often do not mix. In tort law, there's a defense to a plaintiff's cause of action in many jurisdictions known as assumption of the risk. Put succinctly, if someone participates in something dangerous and that person has full knowledge of the dangers, they are said to have assumed the risk of those dangers in a legal sense. For a more detailed explanation, we return to the Olympic sport of speed skating and to Lake Placid, scene of the 1980 Winter Olympics. There's a training facility at Lake Placid, and a two-time Olympic medal winner was practicing there many years later. The court takes up the action. She fell on the ice, hit the fiberglass boards surrounding the rink, and injured her spine. Although pads had been placed on the boards, she fell in such a manner that her feet lifted them up, causing her hip to strike the boards directly. I add, ouch. The speed skater filed a negligence action against the United States Olympic Committee, arguing that it hadn't installed the rink's safety pads to meet international standards, and that those pads therefore hadn't protected her. But the court found that the skater was acutely aware of how the pads were installed, having participated in the process. More importantly, the court explained, she was an athlete who had voluntarily participated in speed skating and had consented to those, quote, commonly appreciated risks, which are inherent in and arise out of the nature of the sport generally and flow from such participation. The court relied on another speed skater who testified in an affidavit that falling speed skaters often strike the protective pads and cause them to move out of position. The plaintiff's accident, therefore, including the moving pads, was an inherent risk of her sport. Given that sort of decision, in that sort of case, you can imagine that it would be tough to convince a court that any spinning, racing, or jumping athlete had not assumed the risks of an icy spin, race, or jump, especially when the Olympic motto is said to be faster, higher, stronger. I'm Amy Gaida.
Earth and Sky.
There are a range of impacts which can justify many of the actions that are going to be taken for climate change. I think the health arguments are not used enough.
You're listening to Dr. Roberto Bertolini of the World Health Organization, or WHO, in Geneva, Switzerland. He heads efforts by the WHO to protect human health from the impacts of climate change.
Now, we have made an analysis in the year 2000 because of weather-related events associated to the initial climate change. There were already 150,000 additional deaths due to a number of diseases that we studied at that time that could be attributable to climate change. We have estimated that this is going probably to be close to double in the last 5 years, and we expect a further increase in the 2010-2020.
According to the WHO, climate change intensifies floods and droughts. Floods can contaminate water and cause fatal illnesses such as diarrhea and cholera. And prolonged droughts can cause food shortages.
In addition to that, we have the problem of air pollution, the problem of heat waves. So these things are also happening now.
Dr. Bertolini said the biggest health impacts are to people in developing countries. But people worldwide face some risk to their health from climate change.
I think this is really an issue of life and survival of the human beings.
More with Dr. Bertolini at our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Esquire Lounge, corner of Walnut and University in historic downtown Champaign. The Esquire Lounge provides an informal atmosphere for drinking and dining, serving fish on Fridays and sandwiches and pizza every day until 1 a.m.